Committee on State Government, Innovation, and Veterans will be in order. Today is Monday, the 20th. Is today Monday? Today is Wednesday. I'm sorry. I'm worried about striped shirts. We're talking about striped shirts here, and someday I'm going to start wearing some, folks. But I don't know how to match the ties, so there's a little secret. So today is Wednesday, and that must mean it's the 26th. Okay. All right. Before I begin, I wanted to remind the members and any interested parties that, of course, the documents for the committee are available, often well in advance, and they will be online and posted with the agenda, or, of course, you can just contact my office if you can't find them. So we're trying to accommodate everyone and make sure they get out in plenty of time for review. So, well, the first item on our agenda is an overview of the Department of Administration. We have the Acting Commissioner, Ryan Church, and a number of others here to present to the committee. So, Mr. Church, if you would come forward and state your name, and I'll let you take off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ryan Church. I'm the Acting Commissioner of the Department of Administration. I have to think about that title since I've had a few changes in recent months. And just a quick background, it was about 3 years ago that I was appointed as a director of one of the divisions in the agency. About 18 months ago, I became the Deputy Commissioner, and even more recently than the Acting Commissioner. So I have to think about that title once in a while, and I've joked with my colleagues that I have a better understanding of that part of my job description that says other duties as assigned. I have to say I'm enjoying the work, and I think like many of the folks in the Department of Administration, we're excited and challenged by this new sense of urgency around reform and doing what we can to make sure that state government administrative services are delivered as efficiently and as effectively as possible. Our goal here, our purpose today, is really just to help acquaint you with the role of the Department of Administration within state government operations. And we're going to go at that in a couple of ways. First of all, appreciate the questions, Mr. Chair, that you sent. They were clear and they were direct, and we're going to try to respond to those accordingly. And what we'll do is I'll provide a very brief overview, kind of our mission, our goals, snapshot of the budget, very quickly, probably 10 minutes or less, give you that overview. And then what we want to do is go into some specific areas within the agency, talk about some business operations, and really key off of what is our approach, what are some recent innovations and results. We don't want to talk about innovation or efficiency in a theoretical way. We want to talk in a very practical way using the data that we have. And then there is also a question that you gave us that pertained to what might be changed in your agency to operate more efficiently in the future. So the folks that will talk about those areas will also talk about things that we see as greater potential. So what can we do even more in the future? So if that's okay, Mr. Chair, I'll proceed on that basis.
That sounds great. Let's do that.
All right. I believe you have some slides with you, and I'll click through these as well. First one we have is who we are. You know, I didn't know this until a couple of weeks ago, but the Department of Administration was created in 1939 for the purposes of actually it was done by Governor Harold Stassen, and the purpose was to reform and professionalize state government administrative services. Now, if you think about the reforms in 1939, you probably could see, well, there's some good things that came about as a result of those reforms, but there's also some unintended consequences. And in fact, some of the reforms we talk about today are dealing with the reforms of the 1930s. So again, as we talk about these examples, we'll try to illustrate what we're doing. But it's important, sort of the key idea here when this was created was to capture economies of scale, to use specialized expertise that could professionalize the services, add value to the services, operate them more efficiently. And those are sound ideas, and much of what we do is based on that basic concept. The other thing that I think is important to understand is that most of admin operates as fee-for-service businesses. This is different than many of the agencies you'll look at. You'll see from our budget, and I'll show that in just a moment, that most of our revenue comes from the fees that we charge our customers. So admin is like a collection of businesses, and that's how we operate. And it's just a basic thing to understand as you think about this agency and you compare it to some others. Our mission, quite simply, is to help our customers succeed. Our customers are primarily state agencies, but let's keep in mind that we also are able to work across jurisdictions, so we're able to work with local governments, school districts, colleges and universities are also part of our customers. There are also others, but it's probably helpful to think about our customers primarily as the agencies across state government. I want to talk about kind of four basic goals that we have in the agency, just so that you understand why they're important to us and how we use them to manage performance of our operation. First of all is this idea to provide customers with valuable services, products, advice, and expertise. When you hear some of the people come forward and talk about their business areas, you will recognize that there are people with specialized expertise. And that's important because if you're in an agency and you need to purchase a mobile healthcare unit, or you need to insure a zoo, or you need to do some of these things that as a manager you just may not know a lot about, it's a tremendous value to be able to turn to an expert within state government, get that help as economically as possible, either through a combination of providing the services directly or going to the market to get that specialized service to support that agency. That simply allows that agency to focus their attention and their resources on their primary mission. The second thing here is to be recognized for our innovation and efficiency. You know, because state agencies are under ongoing cost pressure, it's really important that our services are cost competitive. They got to be the best deal in town, otherwise we're draining the resources off of those operations. So we feel a lot of pressure to make sure that our services are cost competitive. We constantly review that. We compare it to market benchmarks to see what we can do to make sure we do that. But use of technology and other strategies that can be used to operate more innovatively is something that we do. And again, you'll see examples of that in just a moment. To reduce costs by working across government. This goes back to that same basic idea of economies of scale. And I'll just pick on one example right now, and you'll hear some others later. But the Cooperative Purchasing Venture Program is a way that that not only state agencies, but again, local governments, school districts, colleges and universities can purchase off of more than 700 state contracts. So again, it's just a way to pool that spend, use some strategic ways to get the best value for those public dollars, and then extend that service not just within state agencies, but across other jurisdictions. It's one of many examples that we rely upon to do exactly what we just talked about.
So, Mr. Ryan, do you also, are you also able to use any kind of purchasing using federal contracts? You know, I've heard we do have some agencies, specifically veterans, that are able to buy from a federal contract items needed at a lower cost. I mean, do you do that?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's correct, and I think when we get into our examples, we'll have a chance to follow up on that and talk about that example specifically. Moving on to just a quick snapshot of the budget. And again, this goes back to my point earlier. When you look at this, you'll see that I guess it's the kind of light yellow and the light blue areas, the larger parts of the revenues for the agency are fees that we charge to the agencies or to our customers. That the shaded area up in the 12 o'clock to 1 or 2 o'clock there, but for that very fine sliver at the top, which are federal funds, the other two are general fund dollars. About half of those general fund dollars go through pass-through grants. Admin doesn't have any part of those dollars. They're literally an administrative agency that just directs them out. I think public broadcasting would be a good example of one of the larger grantees that is a legislative appropriation, goes directly to those entities. We simply pass those through. But again, the point here is that this, I think, gives you a picture that looks different than many other agencies you might look at, where it's really driven by the fact that we are a collection of businesses within the agency. I want to talk about managing performance because this is, it's important to understand how we use those four goals and then how we drill that down into the agency operations. So Connected to those four broad goals, every business in the agency will then develop specific measurable objectives using data about customer needs, our costs, prior results to develop these benchmarks. Then every quarter, those managers are, they produce a brief written summary of how they're doing. And in fact, I believe you've got a copy of a 210 goal performance summary. This one is just taken from one of the divisions, our plant management division, who we'll actually be hearing from in just a moment as well. So they produce these summaries. What we do on a quarterly basis, then they meet with the leadership team within the agency. These are brief meetings, very focused on the results, looking both at the activities and the goals that we've set out to achieve, the outcome-based goals, to compare, look at the financial condition of the organization, so basically comparing the projected revenues and expenditures with the actuals, and then of course, looking at any way to correct any discrepancy. The other thing that typically happens in these quarterly meetings is pretty free thinking about what could we be doing differently? Where is there a new opportunity? Is there a new opportunity in the marketplace? Is there a new opportunity to get a customer? Is there a way to spread this cost across a greater number of agencies? It's really a chance for us to stimulate our thinking about the options. And that whole process is important because it institutionalizes that practice and it requires us to think more creatively about what we're doing. It helps create this culture of continuous improvement. And it's the only way that we know how at this point to really focus in a business practice way at getting better at what we do every day. With that, I want us to move into these examples, and just let me restate that what we want to do here is give you a chance to look at a little more depth at some of the business areas we're talking about. I know that there's some interest in some of these topics, purchasing, you just mentioned, leasing. We're going to take a look at energy consumption in the capital area, some of those things so that you can get a better feel for the way we use data and the way that we try to always innovate in the work that we do. I can certainly stop for questions now, Mr. Chair, if you like. Otherwise, what we'll do is have folks come up and engage in the dialogue and questions at that point.
Senator Daley.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much, Mr. Church, for this presentation. Appreciate all the effort that you've put into this. I noticed on the 2010 goal performance summary, the same section, to reduce costs by working across state government as your third goal. You've got four goals listed, to reduce costs by working across government. And there's nothing listed except that it says that the University of Minnesota declined to participate. Going forward, what's your vision to make inroads into reducing costs by working across state government? Do you have anything in mind?
You know, Mr. Chair, Senator, I think, again, we've got Dave Fielding from the Plant Management Division can talk about this. This particular one had to do with resource recovery, the recycling services. We had been in conversation with the University of Minnesota about ways that we could work together. I thought we had a good thing going there, but at some point it broke down and the university decided not to go along with us on that project. But certainly there's going to be other things that we can do. You're looking at the, I believe this is the last quarter of the 2010 year. So if we look ahead, yes, there would be different objectives underneath that category, and I think Dave can talk about those.
Okay. All right. Proceed.
Anything else? Great. Well, thank you. I guess with that then, Mr. Chair, what I'll do is ask Kent Allen. Is Kent here?
I'm here.
Great. We'll have Kent come forward and talk about our work in the purchasing area.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Church.
I'm just slide over here.
Mr. Allen, please state your name.
Sure, members, thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Kent Allen. I'm the Chief Procurement Officer for the state and the director of the Materials Management Division within the Department of Administration. Ryan mentioned the admin mission, and if you're looking at our slides here, you'll see that we also have a related mission with respect to state purchasing, and it's really to acquire goods and services for state government that are done in a way that support three particular values you see outlined here. One is getting the best buy for the citizens' dollars. One of the things we've learned in the procurement world in recent years is that cheapest isn't always the best. So what we try to do is find a responsible balance between cost and quality And also factoring in a number of legislative policy objectives that are built into the state procurement process. Highest ethical standards is critical, obviously, in a world where we have billions of dollars, literally, of business opportunities for the private sector. We need to be absolutely certain that those are awarded in a way that keeps Minnesota known as a clean government state, where there's fair and open competition. State statutes in Minnesota actually do a good job of protecting this value. We have very good conflict of interest laws, whistleblower protections, and so forth. And then the legislative and executive priorities is a piece of this, because procurement often becomes a vehicle for other policy objectives. And the legislature and governor through the years have built in a number of those into the processes. It involves things like small business development goals, environmental goals, employment of disabled people, and other sorts of things that are where we use state procurement to advance these broader objectives. The Central Procurement Office plays a slightly different role with respect to these various types of purchasing. With respect to goods and services, the Central Procurement Office is actually responsible under statute for doing the purchasing. And we sometimes do that directly. More frequently, we develop statewide contracts that are available for use by all state agencies, and as Ryan mentioned, frequently local units of government as well. We currently have about 1,500 statewide contracts available for use.
Can you just quickly give us a couple of ideas of a statewide contract that you're using?
Sure. It could be for almost anything that state or local government buys a lot of. So we have contracts for vehicles, computers, heavy equipment, and services as well. I mean, janitorial services and other non-commodity type goods and services.
All right. Thank you.
With respect to professional technical contracts, our role is a little different in that agencies themselves have authority to enter into these contracts. And so the Central Procurement Office really oversees and approves these contracts. But one actual innovation that we've been doing in the last few years is also developing some statewide or enterprise contracts in the professional technical area. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as I proceed through the slides here. And then lastly, we play a large role with respect to cooperative purchasing. Ryan mentioned the cooperative purchasing venture, and that's a program through which we make these state contracts available to local units of government. And there are currently more than 900 local jurisdictions who are using these contracts on a voluntary basis. They don't have to use all of them. They can decide if this is, in fact, their best purchasing option. But it gives the locals a real advantage because they get to be part of the volume purchasing that the state's doing by pooling the purchasing. And it also assures the locals that the contracts have been awarded appropriately and then are easy for them to use. It's a quick and simple process for them. Minnesota, interestingly, also manages the two largest multi-state purchasing cooperatives in the nation. Each of these involves more than $1 billion a year in purchases across most of the 50 states. One of those is called the Minnesota Multi-State Contracting Alliance for Pharmacy, which deals with pharmaceuticals, and the other is a Western States Alliance computer contract. When you add up all the work that the Central Procurement Office does with respect to state agency purchasing, it ends up amounting to slightly over $2 billion a year. The top spending categories probably won't surprise you. Healthcare and medical services is number one, and highway construction and maintenance is number two. And everything else is a fairly distant third and fourth place behind those. The state of Minnesota has very strong and relatively recently refreshed procurement laws. The state procurement law was sort of created or rewritten and overhauled in 1998, and then again in 2007. One group that recently did a case study of Minnesota's procurement system is the Pew Center on the States. And they determined that Minnesota's procurement laws are actually a model of excellence for other states. In these 2007 statutory changes, the primary focus was on what I might call strategic procurement. Historically, procurement has been addressed on more of a transactional basis, and the intent of the 2007 laws is really to allow us to take a more strategic or bigger picture approach to procurement. And the bullets here just describe some of the elements of a strategic approach to procurement. One is simply focusing on more than an agency-by-agency, purchase-by-purchase basis and looking across the enterprise, looking for opportunities to collaborate, work with other jurisdictions. The product standardization is an important aspect of this. Historically, procurement offices usually bought exactly what an agency asked them to buy. What we've done more recently is to convene stakeholder teams who really work at developing some common expectations, standards, and specifications. When these involve IT purchases, we work closely with OET, and then we issue contracts for these products that were sort of agreed upon as the state standardized products. And we really can drive the volume through this process of creating standards and awarding contracts for fewer types of, for fewer specific models and so forth. Negotiations is an aspect, is an element of strategic procurement where Minnesota has really had what I think is major success, and we've really changed the way we do our work. Historically, we used the solicitation process and basically paid whatever the winning responder offered as their price following the solicitation process. What we do now is really take that best price offered and use that as a starting point for negotiations. In the previous biennium, fiscal years 9 and 10, we were able to document that we actually knocked in excess of $60 million off those initial best prices simply by being much more aggressive in negotiating prices with vendors. Some of the things on the slide here, minimum weight for price. Until recently, the state laws didn't require weighting of price at a particular level as you evaluated responses to a solicitation. Now we require that price be weighted at least 30% of the evaluation criteria. That saved the state some money. And we've talked a little bit about cooperative purchasing across jurisdictions, another aspect of this. And spend analysis is really just a better use of data to assist with analysis and extremely helpful with respect to the negotiation and other aspects of this. I have savings and cost avoidance on the slide here. Savings in this area becomes very difficult to quantify. Everybody wants to know, and reasonably so, how much money has the state saved. And it gets really difficult because there's so many unknowns. And we can't really know what we would have paid had we not agreed to these standards. We can't really know what we would have paid if we had had smaller volumes rather than larger volumes. So a lot of the work that we do in this area involves best estimates and assumptions. One area where we do have more precise data is the figure I already gave you, because on that $60 million that we knocked off initial prices, that's pretty tangible and solid. Another estimate that gives you some sense of what I think we're accomplishing, and again, this one involves more speculation around the unknowns, but it's one that was actually endorsed by this Pew Center on the States after they did their case study of Minnesota. Was an estimated savings of $246 million from December of 2005 to July of 2009 by using these strategic sourcing sorts of strategies. So we're proud of that for obvious reasons. And we have, in fact, gotten some national recognition for innovation in procurement in Minnesota. And I won't belabor this too much, but I I did think it'd be helpful to point out that it's not just me who thinks we're doing a relatively good job. There's some objective third parties who have endorsed that point of view. And one of them is the Pew Center on the States. They put out a report which is called States Buying Smarter, Lessons Learned from Minnesota and Virginia. So we were one of two states that were part of this case study. And the Pew Center cites Minnesota for excellence with respect to innovation, negotiation, measurement, collaboration, and persistence. And they say that some of the key elements of Minnesota's success, and some of these reflect on you and our legislative branch, one is a statutory authority for procurement reform, a statutory commitment to ethics and whistleblowers, a robust and independent central procurement agency, and strong joint powers agreement authority enabling two or more public entities to collaborate. Minnesota was also one of seven states whose purchasing and contracting work was viewed as a strength in the most recent Grading the States survey done by Governing Magazine. And Minnesota has won the first place award for procurement excellence in two of the last 4 years by the National Association of State Procurement Officials. So, but of course, we never want to rest on our laurels. So what are we doing today? Some things that are in the works. The SWIFT system, I don't know how much you've heard about the development efforts on the SWIFT system from the MMB department. It's been kind of a struggle. It's a bit behind schedule. But I think that it would be fair to say that when the procurement functionality within the SWIFT system is fully implemented, we will have the most paperless procurement system in the at a state level in the country. So that's something that we're certainly working toward and excited about. We're doing some interesting things with these enterprise contracts. I mentioned that for the first time we're doing enterprise professional technical contracts. One of the areas where I think we have the most success there is it's a partnership with the Office of Enterprise Technology, and we have a program through which consultants can be obtained at a pace that's pretty much unheard of in terms of state contracting. We have 21 vendors on contract, 18 of them are from Minnesota, 9 of them are a minority or female-owned businesses, and all of them are contractually committed to rates for their services that are 25% lower than what we've been paying previously, and to be able to have a contractor on site in a state agency within 48 hours if that's what the state agency, in fact, needs and requires. With respect to these enterprise professional technical contracts, we're also developing some new ones that relate to occupational health, and we are developing some contracts that relate to assisting agencies with accessibility for the disabled in their websites and captioning of their videos and so forth for hearing or seeing impaired individuals. We're also doing some interesting things with new enterprise contracts for goods and services. One of the ones that is brand new and is kind of exciting to me as a travel contract, which for the first time coordinates all the state travel purchases. One of the things that's interesting about it is that, as you know, state employees are prohibited by statute to take advantage of frequent flyer miles that they obtain while flying for the state. So to some degree, the state's been paying for travel and not really getting the full benefit of that because were it not for that, there would occasionally be some free trips involved for somebody. Under this new travel contract, it doesn't change the state policy or the statute with respect to frequent flyer miles, but the travel consolidator that's doing the contract will, in fact, award state agencies some free tickets based on their usage, which will be sort of the equivalent of the frequent flyer miles that we've otherwise been missing out on. So that's an interesting change for the better. Another current innovation that is brand new and is exciting to us is our implementation of the accessibility statutes that this body passed 2 years ago. As you, many of you will remember, you asked the state to ensure that the products that it buys and the websites it develops and so forth are as accessible as possible for individuals with disabilities. And I think this is a case where we really worked across a broad community of stakeholders, and including a number of representatives from the disability community and state agencies, and particularly Office of Enterprise Technology. And I think from a procurement perspective, we solved a problem that really has stymied the federal government and other states, because no one has quite figured out how you build accessibility into the procurement process in a way that works. Well, this group of stakeholders worked to develop a product that we're calling an accessibility matrix that actually balances the objective of getting the most accessible products that are available on the market today, and also balances that with affordability and sort of the market maturity with respect to accessible products. So this is something that's been well received by agencies, and we think we have an approach to buying accessible products that nobody else had figured out yet. So if you're looking at the slides, you're seeing that we now get to future opportunities, and there's nothing there. And that's because a lot of the direction that we will go will be set by the legislature and the new governor. That doesn't mean we don't have ideas about future opportunities, and we're exceptionally proud of our ability to implement pretty much anything that's thrown at us. But just to give you some ideas of areas in which it might be useful for you to be thinking, and in which we would enjoy further conversations with you about the specifics. One certainly is the use of professional technical contracts. I mean, one view is that they are widely overused. And I'm not sure that they're necessarily widely overused, but they're definitely, I think there's an opportunity to examine whether they have been used more extensively than is appropriate. So years ago, the legislature had a moratorium on professional technical contracts, which could be something you could look at again, or creating additional criteria that would have to be examined before agencies entered into professional technical contracts.
Excuse me. Mr. Church, could you provide that for us, and I can get it out to the committee members, because I'm sure that was going to be one of the questions Senator Goodwin was about to ask. No? I'm thinking. But, yeah, we would be interested in seeing any of those outsourcing contracts. And while I'm at it, one thing that I noticed we had asked for that I didn't see here was a full compensation report. Did we get that? Oh, maybe I forgot. We probably forgot to request that from you. We have from the other agencies, but if you could do that, and then we'll get that out to the members.
So Mr. Chairman, a full compensation report, and this question about contracts, outsourcing, I'm not sure I completely understand what you...
Well, it would be nice to see a list of what we might have right now that we're using, outsourcing. Senator Goodwin.
Okay.
I might make a suggestion in that area before you give me a chance to ask my questions, is that you might want to find out what has been spent in the last few bienniums in that area, just to see what,
sure,
you know, whether it's increasing or not. And I know there's a legislative reference library should have a summary available. In fact, you should get a summary from the Department of Finance on that, or Department of Administration, but it would be helpful for all the members to see what, over the past, even the past decade, what the changes have been in that area cost-wise.
Is that possible, Mr. Allen?
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, it is, and I even have with me, and believe me, I won't be able to answer all your questions like this, but I actually have the data for the last couple of years. In FY09, the state spent $430 million on professional technical contracts.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that that maybe reduces the level of opportunity here is that only 36% of that is general fund money going into those contracts. So 158 million of the 430 million was general fund money. The top categories in FY09 were information technology, sort of a generic category that we know included the educational testing done by the Department of Education, and then healthcare in third place, environmental services in fourth, and architectural and engineering in fifth. That was FY09. FY10, the state spent less, $401 million, and of that, only $79 million was general fund money. And top categories in FY10, number one was a sort of generic category that includes the educational testing. number two, informational technology development. Number three, healthcare.
Thank you very much. If you would, I could have Christy here swing by and grab that from you, and we'll make quick copies of it for the members, if that's
okay.
All right. Senator Wigger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Allen, do you know approximately how many state-issued cell phones there are, what the cost is, and any recommendations? I ask that recalling what California had just done and reviewing that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wigger, I said I wouldn't be able to answer all your questions, and you've stumped me on the first one. I believe we can get that number, and I know it's been looked at a couple of times. The state has made some efforts in recent years to ensure that cell phones are assigned as needed rather than as a perk of being a state employee. But beyond that, I don't have a recommendation, and I can't give you a precise number.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Allen, I think one thing that I noticed on your information there is that there's $2.1 billion worth of spending per year on materials and professional technical contracts, the whole purchasing area. And so that's $4.4 billion a biennium. And I just want to point out that kind of that kind of eliminates the argument that government does not create jobs, because those jobs are in the private industry and those jobs are also in the nonprofit industry. So and what you might not have heard is that these agencies each have, you'll not find it in your budget pages. I just want new members to know this, what their amount of professional technical contracting or materials are. That is not a line in the budget. It was in the statute years ago, but the Department of Finance never abided by that statute, so they never did end up putting a line item in the budgets on that. But I think it's real important to note that these are private sector jobs. Each agency has this money buried somewhere in their budget, but nobody can ever tell quite where. And the fact of the matter is that as agency budgets get cut, these contracts get cut or they don't get implemented. So I'm not saying we shouldn't make cuts, or I'm not going to. Just so you know, that cuts that we make do affect private business and nonprofits, and that but for government, a lot of these jobs would not exist. So that's pretty much a statement other than, and I'll have other questions for you that I'd like to talk to you privately about to get caught up on where things are. Mr. Allen, thank you.
Sure. Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chair, I didn't know we were going to have a macroeconomics discussion here today, but I can't help
Important.
Myself. It's true a job's created, but it's created by use of taxpayer dollars.
Right.
Not that that's inherently an evil thing, but if that taxpayer dollar comes from an employer in the private sector that then doesn't hire a private sector employee, we simply lose a private sector employee and replace that employee with another private sector employee that's hired by the government. It's not a bad thing. It's a neutral thing. It's not a job creation. It's getting the job through a different source. So, again, it's neither bad nor good. It depends upon the need for that position, but it's not wealth creation. It's wealth redistribution.
All right, Mr. Allen, anything else?
Uh, Mr. Chair, I'll wrap up pretty quickly here. One other thing I did want to mention with respect to future opportunities is there's always the potential for the legislature to examine the pros and cons of the various sort of policy requirements that have been added to the procurement laws over the years. And believe me, I'm not trying to say that I think these are bad things and you should get rid of them. I mean, every one of these has an important public policy basis behind it and have stakeholders that care a lot about these provisions. But the procurement process does have added complexity and sometimes cost because of the things that we use the procurement process to advance. So, again, all of these have a rationale, but there's a pretty large group of preferences and requirements that have been added over the years by the legislature. It includes things like preferences for certain businesses, a number of environmental concerns, requirements where products are made, immigration-related implications of workers on state contracts, the wage level paid to workers on certain state contracts, affirmative action requirements, prevailing wage requirements, accessibility standards that I was talking about earlier. Again, all of these have a very strong basis in public policy, but they do add to the complexity of the process, and that would be another area where there's some opportunity for this body to reflect on whether these continue to be your priorities.
Well, Mr. Allen, that's very nice of you to bring that up. I would myself be interested in getting more of your thoughts as we always look for streamlining, innovation, anything that we can do that makes it easier for our citizens of this great state. And if you have any ideas, I definitely would like to take time with you at some time, and I can share them with the committee. Thank you for your report.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I'm not really sure how we're doing on time. We were thinking we'd take about 45 minutes, but we are nearly at that point now, so I just want to be respectful of the committee's time. We could go, there's a multiple choice here. We've got a number of options, but one of them I know that you were interested in was hearing about from the LEAN program.
Mm-hmm.
And we could go right to that one, or we've got two others we could also go. It's just a matter of time.
We have plenty of time.
Do you?
You
great.
Bet.
Excellent. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Fielding. I'm the Director of Plant Management in the Department of Administration. Just to give you a little clarity, particularly for those who may not know, plant management, which is a kind of a legacy title for the organization, it's really facilities management and operations services, and it has responsibility for all of the facilities and operations here on the Capitol complex and a few buildings which are located in the metro area, but not necessarily on the complex. We have 22 buildings under our area of responsibility, about 4.5 million square feet. We're responsible for making sure that when you come to work each day, the buildings are open, well lit, HVAC is working properly, and clean. But in addition, we do the things that you sample each day, such as cafeteria services. We take care of the grounds. We're responsible for central mail, which includes both inter-office mail pickup and delivery as well as federal mail. We run the Minnesota bookstore. And there are some other miscellaneous things like parking, which is obviously a highly sensitive issue this time of year when people come back to the Capitol complex. So it's a very comprehensive unit, but suffice to say that it's really all about facilities management. Mr. Church mentioned, and you have in your packet, our report card, as it were, for last year. When I came to the state about 4 years ago, I brought with me a career of management philosophy based on management by objectives. I need to know what it is that I'm expected to do. I need to know the outcomes that we're trying to achieve, and the only way I can get there is through a process similar to what you see outlined. We sit down each year as an organization, both initially at the administration level and then down within our own work unit, and we go line by line using the mission and the goals that Ms. Church outlined for you, and we then develop our own specific goals, which are unique to plant management. And we monitor and measure progress against those goals on a regular basis. We may report to administration on a quarterly basis, but we work this literally every day. The thing I'm going to take you through today is just one line item on that chart, which is energy. In the fall of 2005, the state opened three new buildings here on the complex. The Health Ag Lab, the Orville Freeman Office Building, and the Anderson Office Building. When we did that, we added almost 1 million square feet of new space to the complex and therefore a lot of additional energy as well. And when we sat down in the summer, really, of 2008 to take a look, because in the fall of 2005 there was an executive order calling on agencies, executive branch agencies, to reduce energy consumption by 10%. And really for the first 12 to 18 months, I think it was all about reporting numbers. But there wasn't a lot of work behind it. And when we took a snapshot then after that initial period to see where we were going, you can see that we weren't going in the right direction. Consumption was going up not just because of the additional buildings and the additional square footage, but because consumption was not being managed. We sat around a table long and hard, thought through it, and decided that we needed to go back to basics. And so we started by trying to understand the nature of energy, the forms that we consume. Biggest piece of the pie is electricity, followed by natural gas, and then hot water, obviously winter heating, and the small blue area there is chilled water. We then tried to understand the nature of each of these buildings, and these are the primary ones that we manage. And you can see over there on the far left that the largest consumption, almost 45% of our total consumption, is spread across just three buildings, the two labs, which is out at BCA and now the Health Ag Lab, and then the History Center, in part because the History Center runs a seven-day-a-week operation. We then started saying, well, what is it that we can do? Because there's always a tendency to want to rush to change systems and to spend money and throw money against the problem. But I don't do that until I know that we've got what we have under control. And what this chart shows you is that over 55% of the energy that we consume here is consumed when we're not here. It is in the after hours when we leave tonight and before we come back tomorrow morning, and it's on the weekends. The red that you see there is really the work week. And so the mission here was to try to find a way to find efficiencies through reducing consumption when we're not here and to squeeze down the operating hours in the red when we are here. I should point out to you that we are really blessed to have a system here on the Capitol complex that was put in about 10 years ago. It's a Honeywell software system. They refer to it as EBI, Enterprise Building Integrator, I think it stands for. But it's basically a centralized system that allows us to monitor HVAC, security, and fire across all of our buildings. We have almost 60,000 points that we measure in this system, and we literally manage it real-time 24/7. And so if an air handling unit in a given building doesn't come on when it should, we know it. If it stays running when it shouldn't, we know it, and we can react to it. So with that technology already in hand, and with this profile as you see it, we set about the task of trying to better manage what we already had. And this is an indication of what you can do when you set the goal, when you meet literally every day and manage by the numbers and take corrective action from the time that we really got serious about this until the end of the last fiscal year in June of 2010. We achieved, this is a moving average, we achieved a constant and steady decline. The impact of that against the 2010 budget was that we reduced total energy consumption by over 14%. Just to put it in perspective, our utility costs minus water and sewer run about $9.5 million a year. So obviously a 14.5% reduction is big, big in terms of not only environmental concerns but also in terms of budget. We're under a constant pressure to try to keep our lease rates as low as we possibly can for the agencies, and this is one of the principal ways of doing that. And I can tell you that those savings now have been rolled into the budget planning for the next set of lease rates in the coming biennium. Now, you can see since the end of the fiscal year that we've essentially bottomed out. We've reached a plateau. And that's normal in this kind of a process. So now's the time where we begin to say, okay, what are the next things that we can do? We've got our operation under control, but now we need to look at systems and other ways of achieving further reductions. One of the biggest things that we uncovered in the course of last year, we completed a very comprehensive lighting study on the complex. And what we learned was that the next real big savings in terms of electricity is in the form of lighting in the buildings and also in the parking ramps. If you go by the ramps here or anywhere else really in the metro area for that matter, you will find typically high-pressure sodium lights, which are very energy-consuming, and they run 24/7 because lights are either on or they are off. And when you're in a parking ramp condition, you also have some real issues relating to security. We found a vendor, this is Philips, a manufacturer down in Texas, who is a subsidiary of Philips Lighting, came out with this particular fixture, which is totally LED. It's reflective LED in that you don't look up into these bright beam-me-up Scotty types of lights. In addition, each of these fixtures has individual motion control and photoelectric control. So consequently, in a parking ramp, and you can adjust all of those, in a parking ramp then, you can have these set up in such a way that when a vehicle comes into the space or a person comes into the space, these lights will go up to a full on. After a specified period of time, if there's been no movement in the space, that light will go down to a minimum setting, which is sufficient for life safety and for exiting, but much lower in consumption. Coupling that with the energy savings that comes from LED lighting, those fixtures, when fully implemented in our ramps, will reduce energy consumption over the high-intensity sodium lights that are there by 90%. So we are now in the process of engineering. We've done a test application of this down at the 14th Street ramp. It's been in place now sufficiently long through summer and winter months to give us the confidence to know that we're ready to go. We're engineering now a rollout of this, and you'll start seeing this technology appearing in the parking ramps shortly. In addition, the priorities I mentioned to you about this lighting control that we have through the Honeywell system, but we do not currently have the ability to control general lighting in the space. We've talked about HVAC, we've talked about security and fire, but we don't have the lighting under centralized control yet. We now have a plan, we know what the payback is on it, and we're moving forward. The first step of that was that we had to increase the size of the fiber optic network here on the campus in order to take that additional traffic, and that is now complete. So the next step will be to begin to bring buildings online. There's also technology improving in just general fluorescent fixtures, what they call the Series 800 fluorescents. Considerable reduction in electrical consumption, same output in terms of lumens, and we want to go into a program now of group relamping. Rather than just introducing these as a lamp burns out, we'll go in and do entire floors, entire buildings at a time. Finally, there are still things that can be done in each of our buildings in terms of systems and even potentially software controls. And through a joint effort with an organization, PBEEP, which for those of you that don't know, I have to write it down because it's such a long acronym. It's Public Building Enhanced Energy Efficiency Program. This is something that really has been developed in concert with the Department of Administration, Real Estate and Construction Services. And this gives the state and other state entities the opportunity to have technical advice come in and assess their facilities, make recommendations based on what they find. If the paybacks are sufficient, then there's an opportunity for financing as well to implement the recommended changes based on what they project to be the forecasted savings. So while this only shows five buildings up there, I can tell you that each of our buildings is now either in the process of study or on the list to be studied, and the only two that aren't are being held off that list because there are other mechanical changes that need to be made to the buildings before we do the studies. So we're very proud of what we've been able to do in a relatively short period of time. We've done it really on the cheap, I can tell you, in terms of not having to spend a lot of money. We spent our time making sure that our system was under control. We now have the opportunity to spend some money effectively, and we'll do that, and I'm confident that we'll be back before you in the future with further savings.
All right. Thank you very much. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I just thought I'd mention about the PB. This is something that was also initiated also in cooperation with the Office of Energy Security and Commerce, and that the legislature actually authorized a couple of years ago, and then admin came back and made it a little better last year. So it's a great initiative. I'd be really curious as we see some rollout of some of these changes, how well that works out over time.
Senator Dibble, just to make you aware, the PB did a complete analysis of those ramp lights and the ramp studies and came back and confirmed the savings. So that's really been what we needed for the green light to take it forward.
Great. And Mr. Thanks. Chair,
Senator Dibble.
There's a local unit of government version of PB as well. So some of our towns and schools and park boards and the like can take advantage of a similar initiative.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Fielding.
Can you tell us about the length of time of the payback? The typical payback.
Senator Carlson, as to which particular initiative?
To the initiative on the LED lighting systems.
Senator Carlson, as I recall, the payback on that was about 7 years. And I think one thing to point out that's a very conservative estimate because neither Excel nor PB will allow us to factor in the unavoidable increase in rates.
Sure.
And when you factor those in, we're down under four.
All right. Thank you very much for your report, and keep up the good work. Mr. Church, we have about 12 and a half minutes left.
All right, Mr. Chairman.
So you tell me, can we get through both?
I don't know if that's going to happen. It would depend on questions. The two that we have left are leasing. I know that there were some questions about that, and also we're excited to share what we're doing with the LEAN program.
Well, let's see what we can do. I think I'd like to have the committee for sure here mm-hmm. on leasing.
Right.
That's a considerable amount of money a year. So.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Wayne Wislowski. I am the Director of Real Estate and Construction Services Division. We have four areas of primary responsibility. We're an enterprise function. And we work on leasing. We have the enterprise real property system that you'll be hearing more about. We have construction services. We oversee construction projects on behalf of state agencies. And then we also have an energy program. Mr. Fielding mentioned the PB program. We also have the B3 benchmarking and sustainability program as part of our responsibilities. Just real quickly, I'll get into the leasing specifically. We're a centralized function within state government for leasing. Real estate and construction services performs the leasing functions on behalf of state agencies, and that's by statute. The benefits of this structure include that you have professional staff that are knowledgeable in the industry that are handling negotiations and lease management. You also have a consistent application of the state's space guidelines so that they're applied across all state agencies. And this is has to do with respect not only in when we're leasing space owned by the private sector, but it's also in our state-owned facilities. Here on the Capitol Complex, agencies that our tenants in our buildings, there's an actual lease agreement with each of those tenants, and that is obviously useful from a cost tracking standpoint. I'll start with our services that we provide on the own portfolio and just start by giving just a quick snapshot of what the state owns. We have 5,426 buildings. We have 30,500,000 square feet of space, and that does not include Minsky or U of M. This is strictly state agencies, and you'll see them listed there. There's 20 agencies that have responsibilities for management of state-owned facilities. Just going to get into admin's building specifically that we mentioned. Dave mentioned that there's about 4.5 million square feet of space that's managed by the Department of Administration Plant Management Division, consisting of 22 buildings. One of the key metrics for our leasing group for our admin buildings is the amount of vacancy. If we have vacant space in a building, let's use Centennial Office Building, obviously the costs associated with that vacant space gets allocated then to the other tenants in the building. So the heating, the lighting, the cooling, if you have vacant space, your costs for the tenants in the building is going up. In the Capitol Complex, for those 22 buildings that we're responsible for managing, we're at 0.12% vacancy rate for our office space. Our storage space is somewhat higher than that. We have a facility at 321 Grove, but we're working on an initiative to fill that storage space as well. Now moving to the commercial leases, I'll just give some of the highlights here. In the seven county metro area, we have 196 leases. 111 of those leases are for primarily office space. In the non-metro, we have 590 leases. 238 of those leases are primarily office. But you'll see that the types of leases can range from hangars to helipads to boat slips, just a wide variety of lease types. Overall, there's about 3.6 million square feet of leased space, and that there's 786 total commercial leases. The annual rent for that space is $62 million.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gazelka.
Just a quick question. Are these triple net, or is this?
They are gross. So and that's a very important point, and it actually gets into how we compare ourselves against the metric. Our performance is essentially based on how are we doing compared to the market. The market's constantly changing, so if you have a lease that you negotiated 3 years ago, you have to compare it to the market at the time. In our case, we have a gross lease, and we also our leases are based on usable square feet versus rentable, so there's difference. You have to go through some calculations to get them an apples-to-apples comparison.
And I'll interject here, committee, through some efforts of Senator Jungbauer, who has dealt with leases in real estate. He has taken the initiative. We have already met with some landlords of the state and have been discussing rates, how we can bring our rates down. And it deals with everything from being able to pull out in what some folks call a minute's notice. In other words, we're out of there within 30 days. So obviously some of the rates are going to be a little higher than if we commit that if we decide to move an agency or a group 30 days, 60, 90. So we are taking a good, long, hard look at that as we move forward here.
Mr. Chair, members, and we look forward to the opportunity of working with you to do that as well. Just getting back on average, we see that when we're comparing ourselves to the market, we're performing better than the market, but we that's on average. So there are cases where there's individual leases where there's opportunities to review them and go back to the landlords and try to renegotiate those leases. And I'll just give you some quick examples of leases that we savings that we achieved over the past year through lease renegotiations. The health boards, we renegotiated a 10-year lease, and the savings over that 10-year term is $2,650,000. Corrections and MnCOR savings of $1.3 million over a 10-year term, and higher education savings of $381,000 over a 7-year term. Again, market conditions change. Those leases were originally negotiated several years ago. It gave us an opportunity to go back to those landlords. Typically how that works, and those that work in the industry know, what a landlord's looking for is they want to extend out their term. So if a lease is coming up for expiration, that gives us something to put on the table to encourage them to give us a competitive rate. For larger square footages, the longer term we provide the landlords, typically the better rates that we're able to negotiate. Our typical leases are between a 3 and 5 year term. Our larger spaces, we go out for those longer term leases.
And I think one other thing for the committee members we're looking at is the actual space usage with all the changes and ergonomics and all of these fancy things that they're doing nowadays. We're also looking at how are we using the spaces? Can we compact more into that usable space based on the changes in everything from technology to the size of desks and working areas? So there's a lot that goes into looking at these leases right now.
Mr. Chair, excellent point. And actually, that was going to be my you know, what's our opportunity going forward? That is it. It's around space utilization, in my opinion. We had the opportunity over a year ago to go out and meet with General Mills. And they have a concept that they put in place over a 4-year period called FUSE. And I won't say what that acronym stands for, but it's essentially around flexible work environments. Not new concepts, but it's around hoteling and shared spaces. But essentially, they were able to, in a very work environment that I think everybody would think is would be a very welcoming and nice place to go to work, they were able to drastically reduce their real estate footprint. So we are actually currently just in the process of updating our space standards, and we intend to include a model from General Mills on those flex work environments to promote that with state agencies. Obviously, with telecommuting increasing, you know, it becomes an opportunity, but industry reports suggest that your assigned workstation, if you just walked around and did a survey, and they've actually done this, those assigned workstations are only occupied 40% of the time. So that really talks about a huge opportunity around space utilization.
Thank you very much, sir. Appreciate that. Senator Carlson might have a question here. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wazlowski, I just had one follow-up question. We talked a lot about leasing here. We really didn't talk about some of the construction capital projects financed. Just a quick question about statutes. There is a provision in statute where you don't have to have specific legislative authority for some purchases of and constructions given a certain set of parameters. Can you tell us just a little bit about your understanding of that? Do you use it? If you use it, do you track it?
Mr. Wazlowski, I think he might be talking about, what is it, 16B30 something?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, Mr. Rhodes had just talked to me briefly before the meeting about that. Generally, the appropriations are through the bonding bill for our capital projects. We do get some state agency funded projects where they have operating dollars that they use, whether primarily for asset preservation work within their facilities. And so we do get some projects that are funded with asset preservation dollars, but they're typically just that. They're roof replacements, they're changing out mechanical systems, they're electrical upgrades. It's not new construction, it's not additions to building. That statute does require a notification to the chairs if the overall project's going to exceed a certain dollar threshold. And just this past year, we've had, and this is the first, I've been in this position for 3 years, and this is the first time I've had agencies that actually notified chairs of they were going to use some of their operating dollars, and it was going to be over that dollar threshold that required a notification. So it's not a commonly used statute, but it is available.
Thank you. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Waslowski, isn't it the job of your department to negotiate leases? I'm listening to Mr. Chair talking about how the Senate members are negotiating leases, and I'm wondering how that interferes with the executive branch duties of doing that. Is that appropriate?
Senator Goodwin, I think you might have misheard. We're not negotiating leases. We're looking at and talking to the landlords to get a handle on what's out there, what's available, and letting them know firsthand that we're going to be putting the charge to our agencies to aggressively go after better lease rates. And we're also asking the landlords to help us with the space requirements. And that's what we're looking at doing so we can give direction to the agencies exactly what we would like to have them do when it comes to these leases. So we're not negotiating. Senator Jungbauer brought it to my attention when he was looking at $62, $63 million a year that we spend in leases, and he questioned me why certain boards and commissions were having space leased at $20.45 a square foot as opposed to the size of the area that they're within. So I know he is looking at that, but as far as negotiating a lease, we're not getting into that depth.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Next we have Tom Baumann, and Tom, I'm going to ask you to be as...
I will be as lean as possible.
Show us your leanness.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I shall do that. My name is Tom Baumann. I'm the program leader for the state program of lean, and I want to just give you a brief update on what it's doing and where it's headed. The program began in 2007, and it was really intended to be it's housed within the department administration, but I'm really meant to work across all state agencies. So my clients, the people that I work with, are all 24 cabinet-level state agencies. And the goal was and is to support, introduce, and sustain continuous process improvement efforts within all 24 cabinet-level state agencies. And I'll give you a report card in a bit. We also, not only do we use the lean tools, we want to be inclusive of Six Sigma or total quality management tools and approaches, if you're familiar with those as well. They all come out of the same origins. This goes back to the 1920s. If someone said, what's this new lean thing? It's about 55 to 60 years old, so it's not new at all. It's really a continuation of the methodology to really focus in on process improvement. Are you
sure,
working
I
the board?
Sure, I can do that.
Thank
yeah.
you.
Thank
you. One more.
I failed already.
Thank you. The lean approach, if you're not familiar with it at all, first of all, the term lean is just that. It's applied to this idea of how do you lean out the work you do, lean out the processes that produce the widgets, the work that you do, whatever your organization is. It is all about process improvement. It's not about restructuring. It's not about these kinds of things. It's about looking at how we do the work we do and how to do it more efficiently, more effectively by wringing out the waste. And one of the things you hear a lot about around lean is this concept of seven wastes. And they categorize the waste, a whole list of things. And if you had an hour, I'd be glad to go into those in some detail. But it really is how do you create efficient process to produce high quality while reducing time, cost, and energy. And this has been going on in the private sector, as I mentioned, for 50-plus years. It's fairly new to government. And we are happen to be one of the first states to apply and utilize an enterprise approach. One of the other key elements of the whole lean philosophy is that you engage the people who do the work every day in improving the process. It isn't about the commissioner coming in and say we're going to change process. It's about engaging the people who do the work and making the changes. And this has great power both from a change management perspective, but also these are the people that really understand the strengths and weaknesses of the work they do, and with little help and guidance can really improve that, make them more efficient. In our efforts, we've really tried to engage other public sector entities. Within our trainings and our events, we've included counties, cities, the colleges, the University of Minnesota, because process doesn't care if you're a state agency. Process follows wherever the work goes. And we have a number of processes in state government that start out at county offices. And so if we can engage the county staff in trying to improve the process, we make it better for them, we make it better for us, and ultimately we make it better for the customers that we all attempt to serve. We also have been really happy to have been some effective partnerships with the private sector. We've reached out to them to ask them, how do you make this work? Look for ideas, steal good ideas from them when we can. And we've got a wonderful partnership currently with General Mills, who have been very gracious in providing a lot of resources, lots of ideas. And they actually sent two of their senior VPs to meet with our commissioners and talk about the importance of lean and what they've done with it and how they feel it can be applied to state government. And with this continues, we actually have a member of General Mills on our state lean steering team. I think we'll show the next one. Just a real quick summary of what we've seen to date. We have done 171 what are called Kaizen events, or rapid process improvement events, where you pick a particular process, you bring a team together of people that work in the process, and try to wring out the waste and make it more efficient. In doing that, our average of those 170-plus events is a 66% reduction in the amount of time it takes to produce whatever it is we're being asked to produce. We've also improved quality. We've reduced the amount of task time, which is the actual work as part of the process, by 45%. We have seen an average reduction of about $90,000 per event. We are one of three states, as I mentioned, in the country that have an enterprise effort underway currently. Iowa has started in 2003, and Ohio started about the same time we do, and I'm constantly getting calls from across the country and from Canada and Moscow, even, asking us about what are you doing in Minnesota. We're seeing all kinds of things. Currently, we have 9 state agencies that have instituted a formal continuous process improvement effort. We've had 19 agencies do at least one Kaizen event. Our current league leader is Department of Corrections. They've done 31 individual Kaizen events. 19 agencies have currently facilitators trained. What we're trying to do is build infrastructure within the agencies with their own staff to be able to lead these events and to carry this on without having a big central staff. And we have 20 or 19 agencies that have trained facilitators, 350 or so total. 22 of the 24 agencies have had people trained in lean basics, so they understand the lean philosophy and lean tools. And we've had over 1,500 state employees be involved in our Kaizen events. And in addition, 300 or so senior leaders have been involved with this lean leaders and trying to understand the role of leadership in making process improvement. Lean is a journey. It is a long journey, but I think so far we've realized about $14 million or so in cost savings and avoidance. We have a long ways to go, but state government is rife with process, and so we will have continuous opportunities to do this if we have the opportunity.
Mr. Bauman, thank you very much. I think maybe you should talk to the presenters in front of you to be just a little bit more leaner. We would have given them more time.
Thank you
very much. I'm sure if there's any questions, the committee will be in touch with you. Mr. Church?
Again, thank you, Mr. Chairman, especially for the attention this afternoon. And, you know, one of the things I think you hope you could see from this is that we are trying to focus on results, be business-minded in what we do. And I think one of your questions asked us about what could you all do to help reinforce what we're doing and help us be more efficient. Keep us on that path. I think that's the thing that we need to focus on. And we'll be back to talk more about many of the things that we have. We did not have a chance to talk about everything in the agency, right. But we didn't want to do that. We wanted to focus on a few areas. So, again, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Church. And while we bring up our final item here, I'm going to mention to the committee we will go over 5 minutes because I would like to give Greg Hubinger, the director of Legislative Coordinating Commission, which we'll soon find out throughout our stay here, LCC, some time to speak with us. Because of
the role that we will play in the review of state labor contracts, which will be coming before us at all down the road. So before we begin, state your name, and maybe you could tell us a little bit about the LCC to start with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Greg Huppinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. The LCC is a joint House-Senate commission that is established in law to provide administrative and policy support to the work of the legislature. The commission has 12 members on it, six from the Senate and six from the House, primarily consisting of the leadership from both bodies. All of the staff that work for the LCC are nonpartisan. The LCC has a number of different functions. One is to provide oversight to the other joint entities, such as the Reviser of Statutes and the Legislative Reference Library and, for example, the Pensions Commission. The LCC also provides accounting and payroll services for the joint offices. It prepares fiscal notes on bills that have a fiscal impact on the legislature. So Senator Olson's bill that proposes to reduce the size of the legislature, our office is preparing a fiscal note to sort of estimate the impact of that on the legislature's budget. We also develop the benefit plan for it that establishes terms and conditions of employment generally for all of the employees in the legislature and establishes the insurance package for both staff and members. We also staff a number of commissions and task forces, such as the Region's Candidate Advisory Council and the Ethnic Americans and New Americans Working Group that Senator Torres Ray chaired a couple of years ago. So a number of commissions and task forces that are created for short terms, our office usually provides the staffing support. That's a quick overview of the commission, Mr. Chair. I was asked to talk about the legislature's role in the collective bargaining process for state employees. I think this is a continuation of a discussion that you began a couple of weeks ago when you had the budget overview of Minnesota Management and Budget. I believe that Barb Holmes is talking to you about her division and their negotiations process with state employee unions. You'll recall that 90% of employees in the executive branch are unionized. They're represented by one of 10 unions. By state law, all of the employees in the executive branch are divided up into one of 17 bargaining units. All of those are occupationally based. There's a list of them in your packet, I believe. It's called Executive Branch Represented State Employees at the top. We show the 10 unions there that represent state employees. The middle column shows the types of employees that each of those union represents, and then the number of employees, and then whether they're essential or not. For employee groups that are determined to be essential under state law, those employees do not have the right to strike. If there's an impasse that results from the negotiations, those items at impasse are given to an interest arbitrator who reaches a conclusion about those items, and then that arbitration award and contract are submitted to the legislature for review and approval. I'll talk about that in just a moment. So there are 10 employee unions. The last three, the Interfaculty Organization, the State College Faculty, and the Administrative Service Faculty, are three unions that represent employees exclusively at MNSCU. Those three contracts are negotiated by the Labor Relations Office in the Office of the Chancellor at MNSCU. The bottom third of that page describes employees who are not represented by a union, that 10%. Those are typically managerial or confidential employees who are excluded by law from bargaining. So Ms. Holmes would have indicated that it's her office that's responsible for negotiating terms and conditions of employment with each of the state employee unions. They're beginning that process now, just talking about general parameters and what ought to be covered, some of the language items. They also start the discussion early on in terms of what the health insurance package might be. That's done in a joint labor and management committee because that same package is offered to all of the state employees in one large package. They're working on that contract that will begin this July 1st. Once there is a tentative settlement, the agreement is submitted to the union membership for ratification and approval. If the union membership approves it, then the contract is submitted to the legislature for its approval. By law, the Legislative Coordinating Commission is designated as the legislative office to deal with these state contracts. The LCC has, over the years, established a subcommittee, the Subcommittee on Employee Relations, to process these contracts. That subcommittee has 10 members, five from the Senate and five from the House. And that subcommittee has the authority to review and provide interim approval of contracts and plans. The law is fairly strict about that. subcommittee can only approve a contract on an up or down vote. It doesn't have the ability to modify a contract. And it also specifies that unless the subcommittee rejects that contract within 30 days, it goes into effect. So the presumption is built into the law that a contract will go into effect once it gets to the subcommittee. All of the work of the subcommittee has to be ultimately approved by the full legislature. So there will be a bill introduced in most sessions to ratify the contracts that have been given interim approval by the subcommittee. If the legislature fails to pass that bill, the contracts are voided and the increases in pay or the changes in benefits cease to be paid, and the parties go back to the status quo that existed before the tentative agreement. There's been some amount of discussion in recent years about frustration by members who see the ratification bill coming through and believe that they're sort of rubber stamping things at the end of the line for contracts that have been negotiated months in advance and have been in effect for sometimes many months. There are provisions in law for the legislature to have a role in the front end of the process. By law, MMB, Minnesota Management and Budget, is to advise the subcommittee on the contract negotiations, what the issues are and how things are going. Sometimes this takes the form of the negotiator talking with the chair of the subcommittee and asking, if we present a contract that looks like this, will the subcommittee likely approve it? So there is that feedback loop built in. In addition, there's language in statute that provides for the subcommittee to provide advice to the negotiators. This provision usually comes out when contract negotiations aren't faring very well, when there's increasing talk of a possible employee strike. In that case, the subcommittee will send out some form of communication to Senate and House members soliciting ideas and possible solutions to the impasse. The subcommittee collates that information and then forwards it to the state labor negotiator. Of course, the ultimate way that the legislature can set parameters on the negotiations is to pass a bill that's enacted into law that does exactly that. And the bills that would establish a salary freeze are one form of that. I thought I'd take a minute just to show you the tracking sheet that the subcommittee uses for keeping account of the expenses and increased costs of labor contracts. The second page in the handout that we provided, I think it's titled State Employee Salary Settlements, is a gray and white barred sheet that is the tracking sheet that the subcommittee is using for the contracts for the biennium that we're in now that ends in 6 months. Each of the unions is listed on the left-hand side of that. There's a blank area in the middle where we typically show across-the-board increases that are provided in contracts. For the contracts that are in effect this biennium, none of the contracts or compensation plans had across-the-board increases in them. The next column is the biennial base, which is a calculation of or a snapshot of all the compensation being paid to each of the employee unions that are representing state employees. If there were no changes in compensation from this snapshot, this is how much state employees would expect to get paid this biennium, and it's around $7 billion. The next column is the biennial new money. This is the sum of all of the contract provided increases in compensation for across-the-board increases, step or performance-based increases, increases in health insurance costs, and increased contributions for retirement benefits. For this biennium, the increased cost is about $39 million. I'd point out that about 40% of that amount is an increase in employer contributions to retirement funds, which was required by 2008 legislation. And then another 30% of that cost was increased cost of health insurance that was provided. The last column in that page is probably the most important number that the subcommittee uses. It's the percentage increase biennium to biennium. That's where the subcommittee tracks the impact of this contract on the next. Increases in compensation and benefits tend to get paid out in increments throughout the two-year period of the contract. And so you don't realize the full cost of those until you have to pay them for the full 2 years, which happens in the next contract. A clear example of that is if the employer agreed to a 5% increase on the last day of a contract, you wouldn't spend very much that contract, but it'd be a 5% impact on the next. And so this last column annualizes all of the costs that have been negotiated and increases for that contract and their impact on the next. The last page of the handout is a color bar chart where we show what the cost of settlements for the last 10 years looked like. There's the numbers on the top that are the numbers that drive the bar chart on the bottom. The red bar on the left shows the for the 2002-2003 contracts, the increased cost in the contracts for that biennium. The green bar shows the increased cost or the impact on the next. So the 2002-2003 contracts had a 9.7% impact on the succeeding biennium. The blue bar shows the inflation rate for that biennium. For the 02-03 contract period, that was about 3.6%. I point out two contract periods in this graph. The 04-05 contracts were negotiated shortly after or in the midst of the recession earlier this decade and show an increased cost of about 1.4%. In those contracts, employees received no step increases, I'm sorry, received no across-the-board increases, but did receive step or performance-based increases. The last contract period, the 10-11 biennium, the farthest one to the right, in these contracts, employees did not receive across-the-board increases either, nor did they receive performance-based pay in the first year. They only received them in the second. About half of state employees are at the top of their salary ranges, so they're not eligible for step or performance-based pay. So for most state employees, or for half of them, they have not received an increase of any kind this biennium. Mr. Chair, that's a very quick walkthrough of our data. I'd be happy to answer any questions that I could.
Any questions, Senator Torres-Ray?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was very fast. And I had a question about the increase. You said that on the increase that we had of $8 million, 70% went to pensions and health care. So 40%. Could you repeat that? I didn't catch those numbers. And part of, I think this information is important is because we're talking during this session a lot about freezing salaries and freezing, spending. But there are certain things that we just cannot control. No matter what we do, we're going to have to, the state is going to have to pay for expenses that are out of our control. And healthcare is one of them. And could you talk a little bit about these numbers?
Mr. Hubinger.
Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, yes, for the contracts that are in effect now, approximately 40% of the increased cost was due to an increased employer contribution to retirement funds for state employees. That was required in 2008 legislation. And another 30% of that increased cost was due to increased insurance premiums for state employees. The other 30% was a result of most of it was the result of step or performance-based increase for those employees who are eligible for them in the second year.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Just a little bit about the increased employer contribution to the pensions. That was also paired with a requirement of increased contribution from active employees, correct? And
Mr.
part
Hubinger.
Of that was to address some of the decline in the markets and the pending liability of these pension plans that were accruing.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, that's correct. I think there were equal increases in contribution.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hubinger. And as always, if there's any questions by members, I'm sure they'll be in touch with you.
Gotcha.
Thank you very much. Being there's no other business before this committee.
Mr. Chair, would it be okay if you
Senator
gave us
Wigger?
Big picture for next week? Or
big picture for next week. This is easy. Military on Monday, gambling on Wednesday.
I like
overviews
it.
Or?
Overviews, yes.
I like it.
Yeah. All right.
No, we will.
Senator Senator Daley.
Before we adjourn, I'm troubled by, and I want to just get this in the record, I'm troubled by a comment that Senator Goodwin made earlier, and it's kind of a Yogi Berra-ism. I don't know what I don't know. And if we are spending money on professional technical contracts to private firms, and it's